Hello, and welcome to episode 125 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I'm formerly incarcerated, a policy analyst, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Today's episode is my interview with Eliza Orlins about her run for Manhattan District Attorney and about her work as a public defender. Eliza Orlins is a public defender at the Legal Aid Society in Manhattan. For 13 years, she has dedicated herself to the zealous defense of some of society's most vulnerable individuals. Orlins also appeared in 2004 and again in 2008 as a contestant on the CBS reality show Survivor. In 2018, she appeared on The Amazing Race. Last year, Orlins ran for Manhattan District Attorney on a progressive decarceral platform designed to make real systemic change to our current cruel and criminal legal system. She brought to the national stage issues of ending money bail, decriminalizing sex work, and more. She continues to use her platform to rage against injustice. Welcome to the Decarceration Nation podcast, Eliza.
Thanks for having me.
So good to finally have you on. I always ask the same first question. How did you get from wherever you started in life to where you were fighting against injustice as a public defender and running for office in Manhattan, my own home borough?
I think it's a long history of public service in my family. You know, I always knew that I wanted that would help people. And public defense was such a natural fit. I remember the very first time I was an intern, I think I was 19 years old, and I was living in Manhattan and working at the Legal Aid Society in the criminal defense practice. And a week or two in, I was like, yep, this is it. This is my calling. This is what I'm going to do with my life. And, you know, it's hard to believe that I made that decision 20 years ago, and now here I am, you know, a 13th year public defender still fighting against injustice, you know, seeing the cruel, inhumane way people are treated in our criminal legal system, and really, you know, wanting to make systemic change and representing people on a day-to-day basis.
Now, before I ever got to know you as a person, I saw you a little bit on television. And I think I was originally interested in you because you said even at that time that your goal was to do exactly what you're doing now. So before we get to the serious stuff, I have to ask you a few questions about Survivor since I am a longtime fan of the show.
Of course.
So what led you to being on the show in the first place? How did you kind of end up somehow getting between working towards becoming a public defender and getting on this show that flies you to another part of the world to essentially starve yourself for a couple of weeks?
Yeah, you know, it's not that dissimilar. It's like I made a decision that I was going to be a public defender, and then every step I took from that point forward was to get this job. And similarly, I decided when I saw the first season of Survivor that I was going to be on it. I had on my AOL Instant Messenger bio. I don't know if you remember AIM.
Yes.
I had, you know, future Survivor 9 contestant, and that was the season that I would first be eligible to apply when I turned 21. And amazingly, I sent in my application video on a VHS tape, mind you, and I was lucky enough to get cast the first time I applied. And, you know, the challenge of it, the, you know, physical, emotional, mental challenge, everything about it appealed to me. And so I went on, and then I was lucky enough to get a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity a second time. And CBS called and asked if I'd be on Fans versus Favorites. And then they called again and asked me to participate in The Amazing Race.
Did you have any background in like survival stuff or like being out in the wild and stuff like that when
No.
you did this? Or was it just straight up diving in for the first time? It's got to be pretty.
I'm a city mouse. Did you ever read that book as a kid?
Sure.
I always said I'm a city mouse. I grew up in Manhattan, lived in Beijing and Hong Kong, Washington, D.C. for, you know, middle school through high school. And then was, you know, on a college campus in Syracuse, New York. So I had never really spent any material time outdoors, but I think, you know, the fight that I had in me, the producers saw that. They pushed me, they challenged me. They were like, Eliza, how do we know you're not going to get out there and want to quit and want to go home on day one and be miserable? And I'm like, I have never quit anything in my life. You will carry me off that island in a body bag before I quit the game of Survivor. So they believed me and it was true and they cast me.
So it's, you bring up something I think is kind of interesting about the show. There's kind of this juxtaposition between, you know, unbelievable deprivation, material deprivation, but then you're all this technology is recording you and you've got all these people around. I mean, what it's got to be kind of a surreal experience. What is it like kind of being in this kind of like your steps away from, it's like the old joke where they'd say that, you know, give the starving people water because the cameraman has to have the water. I mean, you're in this situation, but the cameras and the producers and all that stuff are all around you. So what's that like?
It's such a weird thing to say. And I think people struggle to even believe that this is true because they think if you have cameras on you 24/7, you must constantly be noticing the cameras and aware of their prevalence just like all around you at all times. But the reality is that the first day or two, maybe even only the first few hours, you realize that the cameras are there. And then you're so concerned about actually surviving and not getting voted off and who's plotting against you and all these things that the cameras become so secondary to everything else.
And did you, you know, in your two times on the show, are there kind of big takeaways like from your experience or things that you've thought through and maybe learned from or apply in life or any of those kind of things?
You know, there's so many things that really you can draw the parallel between reality TV where you're thrust into this situation with you may not agree with and you have to figure out a way to, you know, make alliances with people who maybe share your ultimate goals, but are not on the same side as you, or maybe who you don't like personally, but you realize that they're your best chance of moving forward. So I think a lot of that applies in life, in public defending, in running for office. Always assume everyone is talking badly about you behind your back. But also I think it was such a test of, you know, my toughness that I was like, oh, I can get through anything. You know, it was such a challenge, such a massive, you know, challenge physically, mentally. And I was like, I made it through that, you know, nothing else will seem hard in comparison. Cause no matter my hardest day public defending, like I can at least grab a granola bar from the vending machine, you know? And so I think that, it was a great experience.
Over the years, there's been kind of a lot of reflection and kind of maybe navel gazing even about kind of what reality television kind of means in our larger kind of life, et cetera. Kind of, have you ever given kind of like takes on the kind of social impact of reality television? And maybe even since we're both social media people, any parallels between?
I mean, I think that there is often a very negative connotation to having appeared on a reality show, especially because Donald Trump was considered like the reality TV president. And so many people said, oh, you know, do you feel like that carries over? Do you think of yourself in that way? You know, and it's such a bizarre experience to have and say, you know, when I went on reality television at 21 years old, I truly genuinely believed that that was me from ever running for office, that was something I would never be able to do. And that I was making a decision between these two things, essentially at 21, and could never have predicted 17 years later that I'd be running for office, especially not, you know, such a serious office as Manhattan District Attorney. But I think that, you know, reality TV represents kind of this escapism. People love it. Like there's something about it. And it's such a bizarre thing that's uniquely human because you're watching other humans recreate these kind of fictional but real scenarios and interact with each other. And, you know, as someone who does a tough job on a day-to-day basis, I don't want to come home and watch some drama. I don't want to cry when I watch TV. I want to watch reality TV. I want to watch garbage. I want to, you know, turn my brain off and not have to think. So I think, you know, how reality TV contributes to society, you know, there are positives and negatives to everything. So can't, you know, make one overarching conclusion, but I do think that some people who've been on reality TV, and I hope you agree that I am in this category of people who uses the platform that I have from having appeared on reality TV in a responsible way, that I use it to push forward the issues that matter deeply. And I think there are other people who fall on the very far other end of the spectrum and use their platforms to perpetuate, you know, QAnon conspiracy theories or to, you know, be racist or be transphobic. And, you know, I strongly disagree with the Times editorial that says free speech is at stake. No, there are repercussions for the things you say. And I think we deplatform people who have dangerous views and that's that.
Just before we totally move off to more serious topics, I have to ask one other question. After, I know you're a fan, you watch the show a lot. Over all the seasons, is there anyone you would put forth as like being one of the most strategic best players that you personally feel like, if you thought that person was there, that's someone you'd really be like, that I'm impressed with that.
Oh my gosh. Well, I think that, you know, the nature of Survivor, whereas physical strength is so valued over strategy in a lot of times and a lot of circumstances, a lot of seasons where people are like, oh, well, we got to keep this person. They're physically strong. And so it has kind of caused and forced the people who maybe are less physically strong to be the most strategic. So I would put, you know, both Ceri Fields and Sandra Diaz-Twine in that category of who are just by far the most brilliant strategists to have ever been on the show.
Well, thanks for indulging me on that. I'm sure everyone who listens to the podcast is like, why are we talking about this? Well, it's because I'm a Geese fan of the All right. So I wanted to have you on for two reasons. The first one is to talk about you running for office, and the second is to talk about you being a public defender. So first, what made you decide to run to be district attorney of Manhattan?
Gosh, it's so funny. Now I feel like it's been so long since I've answered these types of questions and like given my you know, stump speech and whatnot, talking about why I was running. But the reality is, you know, I've been a public defender for the last dozen plus years and have represented 3,000 people charged with crimes. And I've really seen the way in which their lives have been destroyed by prosecutions brought by the Manhattan District Office. Because I've worked exclusively in Manhattan, I've seen how DAs have routinely asked for bail that someone couldn't afford to make and thereby couldn't buy their freedom to fight their case while at liberty. And it has coerced them into taking terrible pleas. You know, then when they're released, they've lost their home, their jobs, their families, you know, everything they've ever worked for. And so just seeing the power of prosecution in the destructive way that prosecutors have just operated with impunity for so long, it made me want to run to try to change the system, to truly change it, not just tinkering on the edges. I'm not going to prosecute marijuana cases like before it was legal in New York. You know, like that's, excuse my language, that's bullshit. Like that's barely scratching the surface of, you know, this whole system needs to be torn down. It's just so, so devastating and damaging. And, you know, I experienced the painful and acute ways in which had I taken office 70 some odd, 78 days ago or whatever it is, you know, people's lives would be materially different.
You know, obviously there's a difference between, I think, when anyone says I'm going to run for office and then the reality of when they start seeing the nuts and bolts of how electoral sausage is made. So one of the things I wanted to ask you is what were some of the surprises or like things that you learned through the process, you know, that were, you know, either shocking or disturbing or upsetting or challenging as you were starting to run for office?
How many hours do you have?
as many as you want.
No, but truly there were so many things that when you go into running for office, if you've never done it before, you just can't possibly. When people tell me they want to run, I say, you know, are you sure? Let's talk about what this really looks like, because it's so hard. It is by far the hardest thing I've ever done. It's absolutely, it's brutal. And it's really the ways in which it could upend your life. It's almost, you can't possibly even comprehend it going into it, how bad it could possibly be. You know, that there are people who are so deeply entrenched in and ingrained, you know, in and invested in the status quo, especially when you're talking about things like ending mass incarceration and you know, not prosecuting people and allowing people not to face prison sentences, you know, and instead be able to participate in programs and do things like that. You know, people are so invested in those things that they are willing to go to great lengths, whether it be destroy not just campaign, but your reputation, your personal life, your, you know, we'll dig up anything. It's, you have to be really sure that you are comfortable having all of that, everything you've ever said in your entire life, every picture you've ever taken, anything public could be put on the cover of the New York Post, theoretically. And so, you know, the things that were surprising are just like how tough it was. I mean, really so unbelievably difficult in so many ways. And I was running in a Democratic primary. So there are a lot of things that people say, that Democrats especially say about Republicans. And I think that a lot of Democrats need to take a very long, hard look in the mirror as to how these things occur within the Democratic Party, the powers of massive, these, you know, massive campaign finance failings that allow for these billionaires to try to buy an election, the ways in which PACs come into play and external funding sources. You know, there's so much of this dark money that people talk about on the Republican side, on the Democratic side too. And so I think that there's like a real, you know, a real like, well, I live in a blue state, in a blue city. The lack of engagement, I think, was really surprising. And, hey, this couldn't be more important. And people are like, yeah, you know, we elect Democrats. It's okay. I don't need to participate in this. And it's like, not all Democrats are created equal. And so I think, you know, some of it was demoralizing, and then some of it was incredible, like really seeing the ways in which build, you know, not just locally, but a national movement. And that, you know, very recently, for example, one of the issues that I took up, which you mentioned in the intro, is sex work and sex work decriminalization. John Oliver did a 25-minute piece on it on Last Week Tonight a couple weeks ago. And that was just like extraordinary. Like the fact that this has become like a mainstream thing that, you know, 11 years ago or whenever, when I first started tweeting about it, and people were like, this is not a popular opinion, like not even remotely. And
well, I mean, he got a lot of backlash for that, unfortunately.
Shifting the conversation, you know, really, really shifting it in a big way, like felt incredible. Felt like I was like, oh my God, like we're getting national press on this. I'm just running this little campaign out of my little apartment, you know? And so some of it was great.
But you've talked about like kind of the, you know, people coming for you kind of sense of it. You've talked about the kind of traditional Democratic Party, you know, politics kind of part of it. But, you know, it seems like there's also like the just constant get up in the early morning to the, you know, middle of the night kind of just never ending campaign. And then there's also, you mentioned a little bit about the kind of money aspect of it. You know, how I had two friends, you and another friend, running for that office. And I was noticing even from you all, who I know this had to have been hard for, you know, pushing out fundraising requests at a really high clip. And that's not because I think you want to bilk people. It's because those are the pressures of the job, of Absolutely. Trying to get that job. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how much of that money pressure and how much of the time pressure is on anyone who's a serious candidate?
Well, it's like you want to spend your days talking about the issues, reasons why you're running, talking about the things that matter, you know, seeking local support from voters, doing voter contact. But the reality is the majority of your day every day is spent asking for money. And it's such a brutal part of running for office. You have to really just spend hours on the phone, call time, calling people you know, calling everyone you've ever met in your entire life, calling strangers and saying, I need you to contribute to my campaign and here's why, because these are the reasons why this matters, et cetera. But it is, the fundraising aspect is brutal.
And why is it that, you know, what is it about doing a campaign that requires so much money? What is that? I'm just, for people who are listening who haven't done this work, and I just want people to get a picture of what our system has been.
Everything costs money. You know, it costs money to pay staff and to pay them fairly. It costs money to, to get voter lists. It costs money to get lit. It costs money to put out advertisements, to reach voters, everything costs money, to have a lawyer, to make sure that you're even going to get on the ballot during petitioning and everything. I mean, it's never ending, all the different things that, you know, stressors that are put on the campaigns of financial. And it's like, if you don't have X amount of money, like you simply can't compete. And especially running in a place like Manhattan against a literal billionaire was uniquely challenging.
Someone might be wondering, well, why in the heck is a decarceration show? Are we talking about this? Well, we've had several legislators who were directly impacted by the justice system, both run and win elections at the state level. One of the things as a movement that I think we often hope for is that more directly impacted people start to run for office. What would be your advice as someone who's kind of gone through this sausage factory to anyone who might be thinking about running? What would you tell them to do or they were starting?
Definitely don't do it. Unless you're prepared to lose every friend you've ever had.
I laugh, but
I think that building institutional support, unfortunately, matters a lot. And we were running this like very like upstart insurgent campaign with very little institutional support. And that made it incredibly challenging. It's so tough to do it anyhow, but when you're really going up against the institutions, whether it be, you know, leftist institutions or just traditional democratic institutions, or if you're running in a R versus D race, I mean, going up against the Republican institution, it's extremely hard to do without institutional support. So I would say get involved locally, get involved, you know, get to know your electeds, show up to things, because getting to, you, all you have to do is be in the room with someone. Like the electeds are very good at now that, especially now that we're back in person, like, you know, going up and saying hello to people and taking photos, and just, you say, you know, I'd like to, you know, have an opportunity to work on your campaign. Can I send you a resume? You know, try to get involved, do a little bit of volunteering, even if you only have a few hours a week. You know, there are plenty of opportunities to get involved and get to know people. And showing up is half the battle.
And, you know, and part of the things I think everybody faces is, you were just kind of mentioning, you know, this constant drumbeat from police, prosecutors, institutional actors, the press, pushing for tough on crime policies against anyone who's trying to change anything. Did you have any takeaways about, I mean, I know you just told people, we'll get involved with those folks and try to build institutional support. But, you know, if our goal is fundamental change, you know, how are we going to finally kind of at least start to get past that divide, that institutional opposition taking us down every time?
Well, don't get me wrong. There are institutions that support decarceral objectives. There are, there are left-wing organizations that get involved in electoral politics, that support candidates who stand for these things. They are out there, you know, shouting about the police all the time. You know, there are some very wonderful progressive elected officials who I think have done remarkable work on issues, who have institutional support. Institutions are not just, you know, the folks who support police and prosecutors and everybody else. You know, there's institutional support on the left also.
We've had a tough couple of years, and despite, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the street, kneeling legislators, lots of election problems, we ended up with even more police spending, less voting, and even less police accountability. I think we've heard some of the NYPD and you're coming through your window.
I know.
How cynical does this make you, and should this make us, about kind of the promise of American democracy?
God.
I asked
this is a bad week for me to come. I feel like I don't want to be so dark and you know, leave people with, I don't want people to be depressed. I don't want people.
Well, I kind of hope that in talking through these depressing things that we get to a place where we think of some bridges out of the depression.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, listen, I have been called a relentless optimist, and I carry that mantle proudly. I think optimism, or as Miriam-Kava says, hope is a discipline. You know, you have to work for it and every day take it on. And listen, I wouldn't get up every day and be a public defender if I didn't have hope that something might go my way at some point, you know, and I certainly wouldn't have run for office, especially non-office, not in DA, if I wasn't relentlessly optimistic. I think there are things to feel good about, you know, the things like I said, like sex work decriminalization was not even remotely on people's minds. It was not on the table. It was not a thing people were willing to talk about until very recently. Like, this has been building over the last couple of years, but like to the point where it is a national topic of conversation now, and a fairly, I would call, like, mainstream view to say we should decriminalize consensual sex work, period. You know, and now, like, there are people saying this. There are people who we've like dragged the Overton window and shifted people to really believing this and understanding why it's so important, which is huge. And then, of course, you know, just even the shift how people look at public defenders. I mean, if you think about the ways that the first time Hillary ran, she was eviscerated for having ever done any public defense work. Oh, you represented horrible people, et cetera, et cetera. And there wasn't that big of a pushback on that. People were just kind of like, that was only like a little part of her career. Like, don't really, you know, they didn't really say, no, not only is that an outrageous attack on her, but in fact, this is something that is a positive that we should be looking at as an asset in bringing about people, not just to elected office, but to judgeships. And now we have a public defender nominated for the highest court in our nation. And it's so exciting that people who have that background of having done public defense work are being, you know, respected and given these opportunities in a really meaningful way.
So you didn't win, unfortunately. The person who did win immediately came out with a, you know, fairly good memo that suggested a lot of things that we probably agree with, not maybe as much as we'd like, but not, you know, and he got eviscerated for it. You know, what are, do you have any thoughts about how we can maybe bridge this kind of press and media narrative thing that happens every, you know, mostly led by police prosecutors, a lot of other things that happen every time someone tries to make substantive change? Or
well, this was so unbelievably predictable that it's just, I mean, it's what an embarrassment that office is for having had any hope, you know, that they were going to accomplish any progressive goals without a strong PR strategy in place. You know, it was one of the first things I said to my opponent, you know, after I lost to him after the primary. This is as much a PR battle as it is a legal one. You need a very strong comms strategy in place months before you take office so that when they come for you, you are ready for it and you have the ability to push back and to say, actually, that's not what the data shows. The data shows that when we don't incarcerate people, we are keeping our city safer. And I have a backbone and a spine and I am not a coward. And this is what I'm going to do. And I'm going to stick to my campaign promises. And unfortunately, you know, even the first month and a half in office, he didn't even have a comms director. And so of course he got eviscerated by the press. You know, the day one memo, I think there were some miscalculations and why he needed to put that out in the way that he did. And the fact of the matter is so many of the things he said in there were things that aren't revolutionary that Vance was already doing. He just never really made an announcement about it. I mean, I haven't had, you know, I've had as many Fairbeat cases since Alvin's been in office as I did, you know, in the couple years leading up to Vance's departure. Like this is, he wasn't prosecuting things already. So to put them in a list like that and make it seem like, you know, it's a, there's a different strategy for getting elected and being a seasoned politician and understanding what actually takes place in the courtroom. And clearly the Bragg administration had a massive failing on. It was just, it's been so disappointing to see him backtrack on so many of the promises that, you know, I've been basically despondent at work these last couple months, just representing clients every day, seeing, you know, the ways in which the things he said in terms of, you know, not seeking, I mean, forget not seeking above the minimum. It's like, you know, seeking decades long sentences, seeking, you know, incarceration, indicting cases, overcharging, you know, bump ups, just so many things that he had said throughout the campaign that then have just fallen by the wayside because of what, a few political attacks. I mean, it's just, it shows such a, I don't know. It's just been extremely disappointing and, you know, just really devastating. I mean, the Rikers Monitor report just came out and it really genuinely is as bad as ever there. It is so, so horrible. And they just continue to ask for bail on cases, any case they possibly can, as though nothing has changed.
So as we wrap this part up, let's say magically you could start over again, this thing again. Is there anything you would, you know, I mean, we just talked about what would happen if you got elected. You'd have a better, really strong PR strategy, which I totally agree with and think was a great suggestion. But what might you have done differently in the campaign?
What a complicated time that I ran. I launched my campaign on March 5th. So 1 week later, we were fully shut down due to COVID. And, you know, it was so hard to every day and week and month adapt to and figure out how to run a campaign virtually, remotely, you know, doing all these things that had never been done. Had it been an in-person campaign, I think things could have been very different had there not been, you know, a pandemic and the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and all of, you know, it was just such a unique situation that I don't think I can look back and really any one thing I would have done different. I mean, I think, are there different ways you can spend money in terms of advertising this, that? I mean, sure, but I don't think that I lost something that was winnable too.
Okay. The second thing I wanted to talk to you about is the work of being a public defender. We currently have a new potential Supreme Court justice in Ketanji Brown Jackson, and she would be the first to come from kind of a public defense background. Why do you think it's so important to have someone with a public, obviously you get the choir on this one, to have someone who is with a public defense background on the bench of the highest court in the land?
Well, so it's not just the you know, professional diversity. It's not just, oh, all these people have come from being prosecutors, corporate lawyers. It's that, you know, the work of a public defender is so unique. It's someone who has represented you know, poor people, indigent clients who could not afford representation, really has fought on behalf of the people, has sat across from them, has listened to their stories, has worked in that way to like fight against all of these powerful interests, the same interests, you know, that were opposing me in my candidacy, or the interests that oppose me in my every single day work as a public defender. You know, it's the prosecutor, police, and the press. And it's just understanding that the ways in which that really shapes your views on the law. And it's just, it's so extraordinary. I think both her values, her intellect, everything about hopefully Justice Jackson is just so incredible. And I think, you know, understanding the racial injustices in which poverty has been realized, you know, they're just the civil rights violation. It's just such a unique position, and having her on the Supreme Court be just incredible.
And the first backlash we heard against her nomination was that she was being chosen because of her race. Obviously offensive and ridiculous, but did you have anything you wanted to say about that?
No, it's outrageous. It's absolutely outrageous. I mean, it's like, I feel like some of the attacks are things like we can't even validate with responses because it's just so stupid. And I don't know, we just have to stop putting white men in these positions.
And, you know, I mean, you talked a little bit about the next objection, which was that she had the temerity to defend criminals.
I know.
Do you want to talk about why maybe our entire system is founded on the idea of a robust and active defense, since you do that for a living?
Well, it's so appropriate. It's like, you know, it's Public Defender Week. It's Public Defense Day. Today's the anniversary of Gideon versus Wainwright, which was decided March 18, 1963. And, you know, said that people have the right to an attorney, even if they're too poor to afford one. And Clarence Gideon wrote that appeal to the Supreme Court in pencil from his jail cell. So, you know, this was someone who like was just completely railroaded by the system, and having public defenders is absolutely critical. I mean, there is a Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel. It's like all of these things, if you think about how deeply important it is to have that representation and to fight back against the powers that be that have all the power, by the way. They still have all the power, even with a public defender standing next to a client representing them. The power is still all on the side of the prosecution. And it's just, it's so critically important to represent folks who I mean, are vulnerable, and to fight back against these.
I think people don't know this necessarily, but it's something like 96% of cases plea, which is more or less a prosecutor win. And then for the ones that go to trial, it's well over 90% the prosecution wins. And a lot of that's because all of the resources and everything are loaded on one side of the ledger. Is that correct?
Always. And it's just so, you know, it's so deeply, the chips are so deeply stacked against people accused of crimes. And I mentioned briefly earlier in terms of bail and plea bargaining and just how coercive the entire nature of the system is, and how people, you know, end up pleading guilty for a whole variety of reasons, some of which include just getting out of jail. So, you know, it's just so, it's just, I mean, it's so
I can feel your frustration falling through the,
you know, it's just, and we have to get ready for these like just dishonest, intellectually dishonest attacks on her that we know are going to come from the likes of Josh Hawley and Tom Cotton
yesterday.
Ted Cruz and these like absolute, pieces of whatever I'm going to say, but, you know,
yeah, that was a definitely, a terrible thread from Hawley yesterday.
Horrible.
Yeah, just a pretty good example of how there's just no bottom to what they'll do. Speaking of terrible attacks, a particular version of the objection was that she had the temerity to defend people who were incarcerated at Gitmo. And given how many people we put at Guantanamo Bay, mm-hmm. who were later released without charge, And given how objectionable the whole place is from like just a human rights, it's just shocking to me that this is an objection. A lot of the people at Guantanamo were literally innocent of nothing. We swept them up, took them from their country and put them in a prison in the middle of Cuba and just left them there with no legal representation. And that she had the temerity to actually try to help them is supposed to be a black mark on her character somehow.
People, you know, who barely care about innocent until proven guilty when it comes to, you know, people in their own backyard, let alone when it comes to people who are Muslim and maybe, you know, accused of something like terrorism. It's like they can barely wrap their minds around how innocent people, how lawyers have to be fighting for innocent people. I mean, it's mind-numbing.
I read a story. There was a guy who was a cab driver, I think in Egypt. They picked him up, moved him there. He had nothing. There was no reason. I mean, it was just someone had accused him of something. And so his whole life is destroyed. He's moved to a country he's never been to. He has no idea the language, doesn't know how to talk to anybody. He's stuck in this terrible place. And ultimately he gets freed. But I mean, come on. That's like years of your life. You're just, just gone for, what did he do? He did nothing. You know, he's just,
nothing. Oh. And it's just, I mean, what they're doing is an attack on our constitution. It's like basic legal principles, like so many things. It's staggering to think about these like right-wing extremists who can't bear the thought of a black woman, let alone a black woman public defender on the Supreme Court, that they'll just say anything. So the attacks will continue. And I assume they'll ramp up on Monday when the hearings start.
Yeah, and one of the things that Mr. Hawley said in his rant yesterday, and I'll only mention one of them because there were like five in there. He was wrong about all of them. They were all terrible. But one of them was about like one of my personal things that I get very fired up about when we're talking about constitutional violation is civil commitment law. And he was very fired up about that. And for those who don't know, that's where you can be put in prison essentially indefinitely simply because someone decides that you're dangerous, not because that you've committed a crime. And there's a person in Illinois, for instance, who has been there for 30 years under civil commitment law in a prison, even though they say it's treatment, not prison. He's literally in a prison for over 30 years and was never tried for a crime. And he's never been accused of, never been put it. He's been in this prison for 30 years. So, you know, I mean, that's one of the things Holly's saying we should try to preserve. Mm-hmm. And the Ketanji Brown Jackson's bad for actually saying, hey, that law is an abomination, which it is. I don't know if you have anything to say about that, but one that I get very fired up about.
Absolutely. It's genuinely a nauseating, outrageous attack, let alone the fact that like, that our country is actually doing it, like that this is even happening. You know, it's despicable.
Yeah.
I know.
And you'd think everybody would think, hey, it's probably not a really good idea to have the government have the power to just decide you're dangerous and then detain you indefinitely with actual charges, without an actual crime, without, you know, on quasi-scientific at best grounds, you know, I don't know. So let's go to the kind of the other end of this. You know, I saw a really good video from Partners for Justice a couple days ago, speaking of the Gideon Day thing, detailing all the amazing interventions of a group of public defenders just during one day. It's just like story, 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 story. And I think people don't always know all the things public defenders do aside from just go to court, all the interventions they do, all the ways they help people. I don't know if you saw the video or not, but, I'm sure you personally have been involved in a lot of things that you do. Can you kind of explain to people all the ways in which you interact with people's lives and how much difference you can make in someone's life from that position, being like the only person that they get to work with, you know, in this terrible part of their.
Yeah. I mean, there are public defenders and, you know, the people who work in our office, social workers, admins, paralegals, and we are like representing a person as a whole person. And so, you know, trying to address all of the issues that person's facing, psychological issues, crises, whether they're experiencing food insecurity or homelessness, housing or family issues, like it's such a holistic practice. There are many things that public defenders are relied upon to do. And then not only that, but also, you know, I'm so grateful for, you know, the folks who are telling these stories and kind of speaking out to try to change the narrative on how important the work that public defenders due is and how vastly underrepresented public defenders are on the courts, and how, you know, when you do have a public defender on a court, they're less likely to send someone to jail or prison, less likely to impose a harsher sentence. And it's just, you know, so critically important that we have public defenders who are standing up in so many elements, like so many different facets of life, to protect everyone.
Yeah. And I mean, I think when we talk about the system being stacked, when every, you know, first of all, you got the prosecutor, then you got the police working for the prosecutor, then you've got the way that the rules of evidence are set up, then you got the fact that they don't have to disclose it, all the things at all the times and all the, you know, the different little things that can, you know, but then you add to the fact that every judge is a former prosecutor. That's, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, that there's it's no surprise that a lot of times judges just kind of rubber stamp prosecution stuff. So I think it would be great, you know, I think this would be a really strong signal that's sent that, you know, we need to have a more balanced court and more balanced courts in general. Another area where I think this happens is in the media. If you watch kind of the major shows, on almost every show, you know, on every news channel, they have a lot of criminal justice people who work with them, but they're almost all prosecutors, police, or former law enforcement of some kind. Why do you think it's so hard for us to get different voices onto those panels, as someone who's done a lot of interviews as you were a candidate?
Well, it's not just getting actual people onto the panels, like, you know, on, I mean, every time we hear from someone on MSNBC or any network, really, it's just like, oh, former prosecutor so-and-so, former, you know, police commissioner so-and-so. And that's who they go to for these views. So it really is difficult. And we have to say, hey, public defenders provide like a very necessary point of view. But it's also in every fictional television show, it's straight up propaganda. And so the way in which the police are portrayed and depicted, the way in which prosecutors are portrayed, and then of course the way in which defense attorneys are portrayed, which is typically negative, you know. If it's a private defense attorney, they're sleazy. If it's a public defender, they're incompetent. And then the prosecutors are like the good guys, always, you know, you're always rooting for them to lock up the bad guy, and the police are getting them to confess and blah, blah, blah. And it's just the whole narrative on any show, even if it's, you know, not just Law and Order or CSI or some of those law enforcement shows, but everything all the way to, you know, people are like, oh, like, I don't really watch cop shows, but like Brooklyn Nine-Nine is super funny. And it's like, every time you laugh along with someone who's being a fake cop, you are literally reinforcing that cops are good, you know, and oh, but they're so likable. Oh, they're just aw shucks, nice guys, like just trying to do their jobs. And it's not that we dislike the individuals necessarily. It's that the institution policing is so inherent that even if someone goes in intending to be a good cop, they're unable to do so given the structures and the mechanisms that are set up.
I mean, the thing I don't get is people's self-interest. You know, it seems to me at the very least, the very, very least, people would say, if we're going to give people the power over life and death, the power to use deadly force, we're going to hold those people to the highest possible standard. Even if you don't believe anything else, if you believe like 98% of the cops are good people, even if you believe every other narrative, you would still think that you'd want to ensure that when they make a decision to use deadly force, that would be held to the highest possible standard, because that could be you. You know, I mean, you may not think it could be you, but trust me, it could be you.
You would think.
You know, but we don't see that. And, you know, we don't see it reflected like you're saying in media. We don't see it reflected. It's just bizarre to me that we think that way. I honestly don't get it.
I mean, I think the police exist to protect interests of the extremely wealthy, to protect corporate interests. And the media also props it up. And it's just, you know, it perpetuates this system where poverty can be criminalized, where people can other those who are merely accused of crimes. Well, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. And I'm like, you realize that most of the people locked up at Rikers are innocent until proven guilty. They have not been convicted of anything. They're just sitting there. You know, the man who died this week was there on $1,000 that he couldn't afford to pay, and now is dead. And people are like, well, you know, shouldn't have committed a crime. It's like he was arraigned on March 9th. Like he was in jail. Yeah, it's not like this is someone who He was accused of a crime and then got locked up in this hellhole and couldn't afford to pay because of, you know, his poverty. And then now has ended up dead. And it's like, I don't understand how to convince people to have empathy for other people. That's the kind of, you know, you say you want to build bridges and it's like, yes, we should build bridges. A friend called me recently and said, how do I convince my new elected? I won't even mention the position because I have to give away who it is. And said, how do I convince my elected to be against solitary confinement? And I said, you know, I don't have an argument for you. I don't have like laying out like the points as to why we shouldn't put people in solitary confinement, because I don't know how to tell someone that they should give a shit about another human being's life. I don't know how to tell someone to have empathy and to see that this is torture under the Geneva Conventions, that this is a human rights violation, that every client I've ever seen put in solitary has decompensated physically and mentally and, you know, broken down. And people like, you know, Khalif Browder and Laylene Polanco and so many others have ended up dead because of it. And it's like, how do you convince someone to care about human life? I don't know. Maybe a bad politician. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I tell people, you know, I didn't do very much time in solitary, but I did a few days. And, you know, what I tell people to do is to go literally, if they've got the willpower, you know, to even try it, to just, you know, take away every piece of tech you have, you know, and basically lock yourself in the bathroom for a couple hours and see how you feel. You know, I mean, like
most people's bathrooms are much bigger than solitary cells.
Yeah, I know,
but
that's
even
the closest thing.
Lay down.
That's the closest thing I could think of is a, you know, I mean, because you just don't understand until you've been sitting in a room for 10 hours by yourself, repeating the alphabet backwards in your head. And you have nothing, you know, I mean, that's all you got, you know, until you've done that for a while, you just don't understand. And some people, I know people who've done, you know, 4, 6, 8 years in solitary. And then, you know, you have people, you know, I have a book in the behind me about a guy who did over 40 years in solitary. And luckily, Albert Woodfrox, he came out and somehow is still sane. I don't, but yeah, it's a terrible, terrible. So I saw a tweet from you yesterday about Kathy Hochul and the bail reform backsliding. I didn't want to make bail a big thing because I talk about it all the time, but do you want to talk about what's happening around bail reform in New York? So they're kind of right cusp of the...
So, you know, it's about more than just bail reform, what Kathy Hochul is trying to do. It's really about it's about just an attack on so many elements of, you know, fighting back against mass incarceration. And I think that what we know is that the safest communities are those that have the most resources, not the highest jail populations. And so we need to protect bail reform at all costs and make investments into the communities, you know, making sure people have housing and jobs and education and health services, and that this pretrial detention, this idea that people should be kept in jail leading up to their trial, someone who's never been convicted of anything, it's racist, it's destabilizing, you know, it separates families, it costs people their jobs and their homes. Like, it is just, it doesn't even address the root causes. In fact, it does make it more likely that a person is going to reoffend or get rearrested afterwards. And so, you know, I the fact that Hochul is doing this is just, it's devastating. It's just, you know, just seeing the political pressure, and it makes it seem like, you know, she's no different from Andrew Cuomo. So she does not have my vote.
So, wow, that's a tough, you don't want to be the same as Andrew Cuomo. That's for sure. So we talked about hope. What are some things you say you're the eternal optimist. I think I've been called pretty optimistic in the past myself. What's some hope? What's something you feel about, you know, I mean, we've had a lot of dark times lately. We've had a lot of disappointments. We've had a lot of upset. What's something we can all kind of rally around and kind of build off of, if there is anything? Aside from,
you know,
that,
I think
we all have to
be very focused on pushing back on any outrageous attacks on KBJ during her hearings next week. That's, I think, incredibly important, because getting a public defender on the Supreme Court is extremely, you know, that should give people hope that we're at a place where that is even feasible is really exciting. And then keep fighting for local issues. I mean, as bad as our you know, governor is on these things now, and our mayor, you know, who's a former police officer himself, who who's done a lot of terrible things. I mean, if you think about the fact that they're talking about issuing, you know, the legalization of marijuana, which I mentioned briefly in New York, that the licenses that they're going to be giving to commercial sellers are going to be these social equity licenses, that it's people who have been harmed by marijuana prosecutions that are going to be the first in line to get these licenses, which is, you know, is a good thing. So pushing on these small issues like makes a huge difference in people's lives, not to say that it can ever undo the harms of having been prosecuted and jailed and, you know, arrested and convicted and having a criminal record, but it's a start, right? Like it's at least something that we're focused on in terms of repairing the harms of these prosecutions, you know, fighting for, you know, there are now two safe injection sites, overdose prevention centers right here in New York City, which are a huge, huge, if you think about
that, is a huge, that is, lives. And that sends a signal to the rest of the country too. That's really, really important.
And by the way, it's not like they've turned into like these crime haven. Like these are places where people can go to not die, you know, we're seeing overdoses. It's not just happening among one community of people. There are people dying from opioid overdoses across the racial, socioeconomic, across all spectrums. And so making sure that people can safely use drugs, which should be legal to begin with, but until they are, that to make sure people can safely use drugs is so, so, so important. And, you know, going and figuring out, you know, if friends of yours are going to be using drugs, or if you know people to carry Narcan, I carry my Narcan all the time. And ideally, you know, go find FentCheck, because there's fentanyl in so many drugs these days. And so, you know, trying to just keep people safe, keep them from overdosing, that the fact that there's like a proliferation of things that are addressing the opioid over, you know, that this crisis, I think is hopeful.
Yeah, it's a huge, I mean, we had, I think, over 100,000 overdoses last year. And, you know, the idea that criminalization is a solution to that is just so ridiculous. And it's so great that there's finally at least a couple of cities in the United States where you at least get your drugs tested, you know, so important. So last year and the last couple of years, people have really liked that I started asking about books. So do you have any favorite criminal justice related books that you'd like to share with the listener?
Ooh, oh my gosh. I'm like, what's right behind me? I'm like, I see, is that Rachel's book there? Yeah.
Yeah, feel free. You're grab it and put it up there if you want. Yeah, that's a good one.
The amazing Rachel Barkow, who, she moderated one of our debates actually.
Oh, great. Yeah.
During the campaign, she's phenomenal. Love her. And then of course, Bryan Stevenson. I think that reading books about criminal justice is obviously extraordinary. And also ones about racial justice and, you know, educating on the history of our, in terms of the way in which our criminal legal system and incarceration really did stem from the racial injustices in this slavery and beyond.
Did you get a chance to read Clint Smith's book last year?
Oh yeah.
How the Word is Passed. Yes, great.
I think that's on my bookshelf too.
Yeah, I was like, it was one of my favorite interviews from last year.
He's
been rolling up the awards too. He just got several awards.
That's extraordinary. And
book of the year awards. Yeah.
Amazing. And then, you know, I think that a conversation that is always extremely difficult, because so many people, and I think you and I have talked about this, people have, I think, come around on criminal justice reform when it comes to low-level nonviolent offenses. And so having conversations about violent crime, I think, is incredibly important. And one of the most extraordinary books on the topic is certainly Danielle Sarid's Until We Reckon. And I think the way that she addresses restorative justice and how right now the way the criminal legal system works, people are like, oh, like, you know, you want to decarcerate so you don't care about victims. And I'm like, it's actually quite the opposite. In fact, in most cases, I'm the only person who cares about the victim. I'm the only person who goes to the victim's home, who sits across a table from them and actually listens to them, hears their story, you know, talks to them about how they are going to move past this, what the ways in which this is has how this has impacted their lives. And that's not, I mean, no one's representing them in a criminal proceeding. Like they think, or sometimes people think that the prosecutors are the lawyers for the victim, but they're not, you know, they're not. And they're like, oh, we have the interests of the state, but they don't actually care. And most victims, when
when push comes to shove, if the victims decide they don't want prosecution, the prosecutors ignore them. Like it's like,
exactly.
Yeah, they just blow them off. Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, the conversations that and what Danielle's organization does in terms of restorative justice, common justice is extraordinary. And most people who have been the victims of violent crimes, when given the opportunity, would opt in to restorative justice and having conversations and figuring out how to make them whole. You know, I think she describes it as like, if someone burns down your house, all the criminal legal system can do for you is go burn down that person's house too, but you're still standing there in front of like the ashes where your house used to be and being like, but what now? You burned their house down too, but now what? Like, how does this help me? Or someone's like pushed you down a hill and you're laying, you know, bloody and broken at the bottom. And someone's like, oh, don't worry, let me go beat the crap out of them too. And you're like, wait, but I'm hurt. Like no one is helping. You have to help. And so the system is not designed to help people. And so I think that addressing violence and really having those conversations is so, so important. Danielle's book, I think is great.
You'll be happy to know that the number one of all time episode of this podcast was with Danielle Surratt.
Oh gosh, that's so awesome.
Yeah, like a lot of people have watched that interview.
She's so extraordinary.
Yeah, she's
and everyone should read Until We Reckon.
Absolutely, the incredible book. I always ask the same last question. Sorry, there, I just messed up right there. What did I mess up? What question should I have asked but did not? You'd think after 100 and however many episodes, I would remember how to ask the same question.
Oh my gosh, no! I think you're amazing, and I'm so grateful for the fight that you're always waging, and it's so challenging. And I think especially when we're thinking about how we can break these cycles, the thing that people say, which is hurt people, is so true. It's so true, and I think that having a place where we really think about healing and rehabilitation and empathy is something that could go a long way.
Well, I want to thank you so much for doing this and for all you do. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Of course, anytime.
Thanks so much. And now my take. I usually have a long rant here, but I just want to read this here today. This is from the New York City Comptroller's Office and was published this week. Data released by the New York City Criminal Justice Agency and the Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice show that the share of released people awaiting trial who are rearrested remained roughly the same before and after implementation of bail reforms. In January 2019, 95% of the roughly 57,000 people awaiting trial were not rearrested that month. In January 2020, 96% of the roughly 45,000 people with a pending case were not rearrested. In December 21, 96% were not rearrested. In each of those months, 99% of the people, regardless of bail or other pretrial conditions, were not rearrested on a violent felony charge. Further rollbacks to the bail reforms passed in 2019 would primarily serve to extract more money from vulnerable communities and increase the number of people held in city jails awaiting trial. And as you probably know, this is my insertion, someone died in Rikers just last week, pre-trial. There is no evidence, and this is back to the comptrollers, there is no evidence that they would lead to a reduction in crime. In other words, rolling back bail reform would not lead to a reduction in crime. This might come as a surprise to people who've listened to the news or read the papers, but as I've been saying for years now, the test of bail reform is
how much new crime happens before bail reform compared to how much happens after bail reform. And in New York, which is where we've seen hundreds and hundreds of anecdotal stories talking about the incredible link between the increase in homicides and the increase in shoplifting and the increase in violence and the increase in crime and bail reform, it turns out it is exactly the same as it was before bail reform. Now, I don't know what to say here, except that it is frustrating to see not just a narrative in New York, but a national narrative turn on what is largely a bunch of nonsense. But that is what has happened. And that's what the press in New York has done to the criminal justice reform dialogue across the country. And it's time for it to stop. And it's about time all of those people who've been printing those terrible stories for the last 2 years either need to apologize or write the story the way it should be written. There are people's lives that are on the line. There are people right now in Rikers Island who could die tonight. Let's stop this nonsense. Bail reform does not cause increased crime. Rolling back bail reform will not reduce crime. All bail reform does is ensure that poor people do not have to spend as much time in pretrial incarceration as rich people who committed the exact same crime. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/decarcerationnation. For those of you who prefer a one-time donation, you can now go to our website and give a one-time donation. Thanks to all of you who have joined us from Patreon or who have ever given a donation. You can also support us in other non-monetary ways by leaving a 5-star review on iTunes or add us on Stitcher, Spotify, or from your favorite podcast app. Special thanks to Andrew Stein, who does the editing and post-production for me, to Ann Espo for helping with our transcripts and social media images, and to Alex Mayo, who helps with our website. Make sure and add us on social media and share our posts across your networks. Also, thanks to my employer Safe in Just Michigan for helping to support the Decarceration Nation podcast. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.